Welcome to Dead Pilot Society, the podcast that takes comedy pilots from A-list writers that were sold and developed at networks but never produced, and gives them the table reads they never got a chance to have. Except that we're not doing any of that this episode. This is a very special episode. Not very special like when that bike shop owner almost molested Arnold on Different Strokes, but still very special. In this episode, we're going to get the executive side of the story. You know, since we deal in pilots that didn't go forward, it'd be easy for this show to make the network executives the villains. I don't think we actually do that a lot. Most of the writers we interview are seasoned veterans, and they know how the system works, that not every pilot can move forward. You know, they may be frustrated, but I haven't encountered a lot of vilifying of executives. But still, I think there is room for some more empathy between writers and executives. That's one of the impetuses. For this episode. Another is that I just had a lot of very specific questions about pitching and the pilot development process that I've never gotten to directly ask an executive. And in this case, it's an executive who's not running a comedy department at the moment, so she could be pretty honest. So let me tell you about my guest. My guest is Jamila Hunter. Jamila Hunter was most recently president of Kenya Barris's Netflix-based production company. Before that, she served as senior vice president of ABC Comedy, and under her leadership, ABC successfully launched the highly rated reboot of Roseanne, as well as The Conners and Splitting Up Together. Before she was senior VP, Jamila was vice president of ABC Comedy for 5 years, where she worked on projects ranging from Blackish to Fresh Off the Boat to Last Man Standing. And prior to that, she worked her way up the executive ranks through various development roles in comedy, alternative and digital programming at NBC, Bravo, the Oprah Winfrey Network, and 20th Century Fox Television. Jamila is someone I like and respect a lot, and I came away from our conversation with a better appreciation of just how hard that network comedy job is. You know, she couldn't remember the exact stats when we were talking on the mic, but she emailed them to me later. For the 2017 to 2018 season, ABC Comedy heard 264 pitches and received 72 spec scripts. So that's a total of 331 total pilot ideas submitted. They ended up developing 45 projects that year. So if you're keeping track, that's about 13.5% of the things that were submitted. So I think there's a lot of valuable information in this interview for writers who are trying to sell their ideas. You know, and I know the broadcast model is fading, but I think a lot of this pertains to cable and streaming too. And if you're not a writer, but you're just a fan of television or of Dead Pilot Society, I think it's useful to get a better understanding that the executives aren't these faceless evil buzzkills, but they're people trying really hard to get writers' visions on the air and working in a very flawed system. So this is a lot of fun to do. Here's my conversation with Jamila Hunter after a brief message.
Hi, I'm Dave Hill from Show Business. And while I'm not from Canada, my grandfather Clarence Vincent Blake Sr. was, and he wouldn't shut up about it. My grandfather moved on to that great penalty box in the sky way back in the 80s. Still, all these years later, I can't help but wonder, what do we really know about Canada and its people? Which is why my friend Chris Gersbeck and I decided to make So, You're Canadian. Brand new podcast from the Maximum Fun Network, on which I attempt to get to know our neighbors to the north, one Canadian at a time. Coming to Maximum Fun, August 27th. And I'm not sorry.
All right, Jamila Hunter, thank you for doing this.
Hi, Andrew.
It's so nice to be doing this, like, so much less pressure than if I was pitching to you.
Yes, for sure. Thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so many questions that, let's start with basics. So it's pitching season. You're at ABC.
Mm-hmm.
You're running comedy at ABC. Over the course of that season, give me an estimate of how many pitches you would hear.
You know, that's a question. I generally used to have the number really teed up because we do a count every year. I feel like it's somewhere in the area of 250.
250. I think. So that's over the course of how many months? So you start hearing these in what, June?
It's probably more like August, actually.
Not till August. Okay, so from August, and then you're done by what, October?
October, it ekes into November, the later people get stuff in.
So three.
And not saying things don't trickle in July, but I feel like after 4th of July, it gets a little bit more like focused.
Okay. So July, so about three and a half months, you're hearing around 250 pitches.
I think so. And honestly, I have the number somewhere. I am going to check and get it back to you.
Okay.
Because right. It might be more than that.
Intro,
yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, I will.
You think
I'll
it might be more.
I think it might be more.
So of those 250, you would be buying how many?
Depending on the year, I would say anywhere from 40 to 60.
Okay. And then of those 40 to 60, you're shooting
10,
8 to 12,
right.
Basically somewhere
right
in there.
Low end 8, high end 12.
Okay. So I'm sure someone could do the math of how many that is a day, but
it's a lot of pitches.
It's a lot of pitches. So what, you're hearing maybe 8 a day?
Around there. At the height of the season, there are definitely days where you're hearing like a pitch every hour from like 9 to 6. And there might be two rooms going. I think at ABC, we sometimes split up. I think other networks, they all heard every pitch together. And I don't know how they possibly heard everything. Easily you could hear like 6 to 8 a day for sure.
Okay, so what would you say you're primarily listening for when you hear those pitches? Can you put your finger on one element?
It should be funny.
Okay.
Which seems super obvious.
I was curious how important, where funny lands on that list of top things, but it's interesting that it's the first thing that
it is the first thing I say, and it's the first thing I say because everyone just assumes, or not assumes, I don't know what people think. Actually, because when people come in, and if you're like very well researched and really well prepared, and it's like there's no clarity around where the humor comes from. Like, I work in the comedy department, let alone there are for sure people that are very charming and entertaining that are not remotely prepared that will sell a pitch in the room because they entertained people. 100%. I'm not proud of that, but it 100% makes a difference. And I actually remember talking to some people in the UK one year about like our pitch system. You know, the UK development is very different. They commission and, you know, it's very different. And I was explaining it to them and I was saying how sometimes it's hard because I worked at a studio also when I worked at 20th, because you might have an amazing writer who's just not a great pitcher.
Right.
And you have some people that are great pitchers, but not actually great executors, but they're going to sell every year because in the room, it's kind of a performance. And this particular producer said to me, well, why don't you just hire actors to do your pitches? And I was like, oh, that actually might make more sense than like torturing writers who that's not their natural inclination to like do this like 45 minute show.
Yeah.
So that is my long-winded way of saying there's a million things that are actually important, but the pitches that I remember the most were the ones that were the funniest.
So when, because I sold a show that I supervised with three actors writing,
right?
And I'm not going to do anything. You guys,
let them go.
So you probably heard pitches from actor writers. So what you are saying is the performers have a leg up in pitching. They do.
They for sure do. I mean, when I was on the studio side, you know, you have a pitch and let's say there's a particular one I remember that Will Smith was executive producing. You're going to sell that. Like, you just aren't. Like, Will Smith's in the room. He was in the room. Well, we made sure of it, right? Because we're sellers. And then I remember at the point when the script comes in, the executive who is at Fox was like, it just isn't as magical. I'm like, because Will Smith is not actually here. And again, when I was selling, you know, it was like kind of not by any means necessary. Obviously, you want a show that has legs and you hope it does. But if you can stack the room with people that are entertaining and funny, it obviously, if you're both great, but it definitely makes a huge difference if you're super dry and straightforward and not entertaining. Again, that executive is hearing pitches all day long back to back. Are they going to remember that person who really made them laugh? Or are they going to remember that person who had a very clear log line? Like the things that I have to go then pitch up to, whether that was my boss or the president of the network, I'm going to them. They have 5 minutes. Like if I have to convince them that they should buy this pitch, I have to have an elevator pitch for them and be entertaining. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. But that sounds like, you know, a great log line. You know, so
Will
Smith, when you're pitching up to your boss, you don't have Will Smith.
No.
Right? So the magic of Will Smith being in the room goes away once you have to then be selling it.
Get it up the ladder.
But yet that sort of seems to still cancel that out.
Well, look, if Will Smith's there, the president's there.
Okay, so you're that's done. True, right.
So there's, again, and we're talking, that's more like on the studio producing side strategy of like who's in the room. Or again, if you're with actors, who do you make sure is in the room? I'm sure when you pitched with Warner Brothers or whatever studio, right, there's that strategy. But I think that, I remember Paul Lee, who was president while I was there, one day said, he goes, you always have those notebooks. And I go, Paul, we're taking notes. Like, whatever, they're not for show. Yeah. But legitimately, we would get together the end of the day and talk through all the pitches. And we as executives have to be able to sell your show to our, at least the way we worked at ABC, to our team, because everybody didn't necessarily hear the pitch. And if Paul wasn't in it, we needed to be able to sell it up to him. So being able to, you know, be succinct about the concept, but also be really clear what the comedic point of view was, are the things we're listening for.
Right. So essentially, so I think it's something, I mean, writers are probably not thinking about, because I'm realizing I'm not thinking this, that when I'm pitching to you, you're listening, how am I then going to succinctly pitch this upstairs, right?
When we're writing, I mean, everyone's different in terms of what they're writing in their notebooks. I'd be curious to know.
Yeah.
We should get everyone's notebooks. So I definitely would write certain information. Writing helps me remember things, but the things I would really take note of are very specific character traits, or again, something that was memorable or really funny, because the broad strokes you're going to remember.
Right.
If it's
the premise.
The premise you're going to remember, those sorts of things. But if there's something really unique about that character, then I'm going to want to pitch that later to be like, oh my God, they have this hilarious friend who blah, blah, blah. It's the things that are unique or distinctive.
Right. And again, those are probably the things that are funniest. You're excited to pitch like some really funny.
You haven't heard this before. This really stood out of the clutter.
Okay. So comedy is job one in the pitch. And even to the extent.
Hiring actors. I'm just kidding.
It can probably overcome some other weaknnesses. That if
the writer is an amazing writer and everyone knows their material, there are definitely those writers that everybody, you know, knows like pitching's not their thing, but that pen to paper they're going to deliver. So you're going, which is probably the better way to do our business, quite frankly. But so the, you know, those pitches you're in, but you're going, I know this person delivers. They're not necessarily a great pitcher, right, but I know their material.
You can forgive some wooden delivery if you know their work. So how much does it matter whether someone is reading off of a page versus like being off book and being able to just, you know, make eye contact and not be looking down and reading their pitch?
I think having pages or notes is not bad. I think if having the pages or notes means you're literally reading and looking down the whole time and not making eye contact and not being an engaging presenter, then I think it's a problem.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
So I don't think it's like you have to be off book, but I think it should be a crib sheet. Like it shouldn't be I'm literally, because then just email me the pages and I'll read them.
Right.
Like why sit there and torture yourself?
Yeah. Okay. So funny number one, what, you know, it sounds like a great character or thing. How about something, the theme or something being sort of zeitgeisty or matching up with something that you guys talked about that you're looking for in your retreat? Like, where do those kinds of things fall in terms of importance when you're listening to these things?
Definitely feeling the show having a reason for being, at least when I was at ABC, was very important to us and our brand. I don't think everybody buys along those tenants necessarily, but having a point of view and having something that felt relevant and timely was something that was very important to us when we listened to pitches. That if it felt like, you know, we're just 20-somethings trying to get a girl, that just felt like, how are you going to make noise with that? How does that feel like it's actually socially relevant? And granted, it's not our jobs to be sociologists, but on the other hand, I think in some of the best entertainment, you see it's reflecting our society and hopefully advancing it also while entertaining and making people laugh. So I think the shows that we did when I was at ABC, whether that's Fresh Off the Boat or Black-ish or predating me, The Middle or Modern Family, reflect that want to really reflect our society and have something to say about it through being entertaining. So that was something that we very much listened for. Definitely things that we've talked about our retreats. If you're going, we really want to do blended families, or, you know, again, we did a lot of family shows at the time, but there's always something that comes in that you were never looking for and that you go, because when we bought Work It from you guys, I don't know if I'm allowed to reference these, like nobody was like going, we're looking for this.
For a cross-dressing show? No, definitely not.
But it was really funny. You guys were very thoughtful. You had a really interesting analysis of like our society and what was going on with men and women. And all of us were like, huh, we really... I think we're surprised that we actually... Well, you're laughing, but you know, it's your show.
No, I don't.
So I think they're for sure the things you're listening for, and then there are the things that just... you hear it, and you're like, oh, right, it resonates with you. And I do think having some sense of reflecting the world in a way that feels distinctive is what's the fun part about hearing pitches.
Right. How about autobiographical elements? How... important is that, and do you? I mean, let's start with how important is that? That some that a pitch have some you know autobiographical you know.
I think it really helps to have some reason you're telling that story, so that if you're coming in saying I want to do a show about frogs and you have no personal connection to it at all, even if you didn't live it, that you have some reason to tell it. I think that matters just because it gives you a sense that this person really has a passion and a vision for this subject. If it feels like commerce, you know, like it's, I call them like paint by number shows. Like everybody wants this year. So I'm buying that. I just have never experienced things like that go in the distance. So that isn't to say they don't get bought, or that isn't to say there's not, it's impossible to sell it. But I think somewhere in the pitch, talking about your personal connection to the subject is important.
So do you see through it when writers try and make things seem like they're autobiographical when they're really not?
For sure. Oh, for sure.
It's obvious. Yeah. It's as obvious as we worry that it is. So it sounds like it's more passion. And that passion could be coming from, oh, this is my story of my life, my family, whatever. Or it could be, it's my passion to tell a story, this science fiction thing or whatever it is.
Right.
I just feel passionate
about. Yes, I would, even, if it's not personal, be what's clear about your, because by the way, knock on wood, it works. This is going to be your life for, you know, who knows how long. So what is it that makes you want to tell that story is what I think people are listening for.
Right. And do you... like to hear the pilot story when you're hearing the pitch, or does that not matter?
I think it helps to have, I don't think you have to go beat for beat through the pilot, but I think like a quick summary of what you see the pilot story as being is useful. And as you've experienced, sometimes you stick with that pilot story, sometimes you don't. That's why I said I don't think anyone expects you to go into it in huge detail, but giving some sense of sort of what the inciting incident is, or just how the series kicks off, I do think is helpful, because it gives you sort of a location for like, okay, what is the sort of thrust of the series, at least what's our reason for starting off.
Right. And how about if it just sounds like that's an amazing pilot episode, how clear does it have to be what season four is going to be?
Season four? Who knows, Andrew? No, I'm just kidding. Season four? I don't think it has to be that clear. I mean, I remember working at 20th and Lynn Barry covered How I Met Your Mother. And I'm like, Lynn, did they know where they wanted to? I think they had an idea, right. But I don't believe they pitched it all the way. And you find it as the series goes. So I think probably different from drama where they're more serialized or there's certain things. It's more about giving some examples of the types of stories you'd want to tell than it is going, oh, here's the full like narrative thrust of character arcs, especially in the pitch.
Right. You want to have some sense that there's something beyond, that it's not a movie.
That there's some drivers for story going forward.
Right.
But I also think, again, for me, point of view is so important in comedy that if your characters are really clear, then you should be able to know, like, okay, if this person's in the grocery store, that's why that's going to be different from X person, even as a story. Again, some of the best sitcoms aren't, like, hugely plot-driven. They're character and point-of-view driven. So if you set up really interesting characters in your pitch, and then you say, here are the sort of experiences I want to put them in, it should be clear, like, oh, right, there's some fun things to do with these characters. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah. And then I guess, the trick always pitching is if you have something that's low concept and that is really
right.
based on these characters, is conveying those characters, you know, in this format of
right.
pitching, conveying those characters, especially if you're not an actor and a performer who can just in that room suddenly inhabit a bunch
right.
of different characters and act it out for you, how you do convey these characters are going to be so unique and great. Like, how have you, do you remember examples of people doing that really well who weren't actors, just making the characters
very
clear?
I probably shouldn't do this. Can I reference an interview you're going to do? Can
sure.
I not? Yeah. No, because I think Sami Falvey talks very like specifically about when David Cast pitched Happy Endings, which, you know, is a Friends ensemble. I mean, it had a bit of a high concept in terms of The Runaway Bride, but it predated my time at ABC, but she really talks about how they hear any number of like 20 something ensembles, but David came in and was so specific about his Friends and the characters and what he wanted to do that it stood out from the rest. So I'm sure I've heard some. That one's just coming to mind because I remember watching the pilot, and at the end of it, there's like a scene where they're all in the diner and they're talking about how hard it is to make friends in your 30s. And I was like, it is, right? Like, you better just stick with who you have. But that, like, that specific genre is really hard. Like, I think that's why that show is still talked about, of like, when is it coming back? Because finding a group of actors that have that kind of chemistry, that character specificity, and that you actually want to like bring into your house every day is really, really hard.
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing. I, you know, having
worked on Friends,
people are always like, where's the next, you know, give us a, just, like, there's so much lightning.
Can you believe how many people still watch Friends? Like, that young people are growing up with those characters.
I know someone was just talking about how long the line was on Robertson because they made Coffee Bean into a central
park. Oh, they did.
It's like, you wouldn't believe how long this
and it was like young kids, I bet.
Yeah, and it's insane.
Insane but awesome. I think when you hit it, it's timeless.
Yes, and it's a combination
of it's like the hardest thing to do.
And it is harder now with the number of shows that are on and how spread thin the acting pool is to get a cast where everyone is just can kill, you know, which Friends was, which Happy Endings was, you know, that you have every person in that cast is great.
Right.
And, you know, that's just really hard to do. The writing can be fantastic, but if you don't have those people who are so compelling. So did you ever buy, these are all the, I'm giving you all the paranoid things that writers think.
Oh, no.
Do you ever buy defensively? Is there ever something where it's like, you know, another network was bidding and you don't, and you sort of want to have it? Do you mean, do you ever buy sort of those kind of strategic reasons?
When you mean defensively, like, do I want it or
you just,
I just don't want them to have it?
You just don't want that.
No, I have not done that. Out of pure spite. No, I haven't done that. Look, definitely there are things that if it hadn't been bought already, I would have maybe thought harder about, but because I knew somebody else bought it, I was like, well, I gotta buy it too.
Right.
But I always liked it. There always was something about it that I liked.
But that does affect your thinking. If they're coming in, we already have bids from...
Yeah, that's why everyone does those calls. I already have a buyer, so you're like, you know, jacked up to be competitive about it.
You're already thinking, oh, this must be pretty good.
Somebody already wants it.
Yeah.
Yes. So I feel like that is more
how about on. Like, how important, obviously we talked about Will Smith being in the room and there's certain, you know, auspices like that. You know, are there other times where the pod or the attachment or whatever, those are really, how important are those? Like, can that put a pitch that you might have been lukewarm on over the top because it's a director or some other element like that you want to be in business with?
Yes, but you have to like believe in the writer and believe in the pitch. Like, we didn't buy anything if it was like, oh, we love that director, but that idea, like, to your point, even about getting all the pieces aligned, I think having a great director for sure helps. And not that we have to get into this, but when it gets into penalties and, you know, like packaging, I feel like that's a little bit more where those sorts of what are the different elements come into play that can drive the cost up. But at the end of the day, you have to believe that writer has a vision for the show.
Right.
And the non-writing producers, look, it matters in terms of there are producers out there that are amazing at getting that talent that you're going to need. As you said, in a marketplace that is incredibly competitive with so many people making shows, you know that Aaron Kaplan is going to figure out how to get that actor that everybody wants that pilot season. So there are for sure producers that you know are going to be like just not another layer of notes, but people that are actually going to, again, add value to making this project reach its full potential in an environment that's gotten increasingly difficult to get all of those elements together.
So it really does, it helps to walk in with someone like Aaron Kaplan.
Hi, Aaron. I'm just kidding. Yeah, tell me, get a shout out. I think if you're working with a like non-writing producer, being really clear about what the role of that producer is something that I've, like Jamie Tarsus, I think is amazing. Like there are people for sure, John Davis, who I work with a lot. But again, those are people that are like not about going, oh, I'm just giving more notes. They're really about really getting out there and making sure you have the right directors, have the right talent, are getting the marketing campaign you need. Like they're doing the job of the producer to garner as much of the resources that you need to help this product stand out. So I think there are those people that when they come in the door, you know that they're going to be like hustling. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you would, even though at ABC you had those two rooms, you were able to buy things in the room when you were running mm-hmm. At what point would it normally, would you ever know even before, you know, you've heard the idea, you know the writer, would you kind of be teed up like, I'm probably going to buy this in the room? Or is there a certain point where it would click in, you know, because I've been in those rooms where it doesn't seem like the people in that room are like conferring or anything. It was just the person, your friend was just saying like, okay,
we're in, we're buying.
You didn't see the wink?
No, I'm just kidding. Was there the pencil secret? Drop?
Yeah, those notebooks somehow wired together that you were taking notes of? How would that work?
A couple different ways. You definitely look before you even get into pitch season, whenever you hear about networks being like at retreats and all of that, like you're combing through writers' list, you know the writers that you want to be in business with, you're tracking with the studios, who's doing what ideas do they have, you're looking at what your needs are. You're already like have lists of studios and who's doing family shows, who's doing workplace, and what do you think is going to be competitive. So like, believe it or not, when there's a lot of thinking that goes into looking at the landscape of what you think is going to come in, and strategizing about where you think you're going to need to be aggressive. So are you predisposed? Definitely. In terms of if there's, again, that person that you really want to work with, or that you worked with before and want to do it again, or there's a concept that you love. So before things come in, we've definitely talked about it and either been like, we know we want a family show and we know Reich and Cohen do those well. So if they don't come in and like miff it, you're probably going to sell it. Your showrunners, you know, like there's certain things that going into the room, people are going to be predisposed to buy. I think if you're a totally new face, you're like a blank slate, then they probably don't have some sense of like, are we going for this or not? But again, by the time your pitch comes in, the studio's cleared it, maybe your agent is called, we know whether it's sold or not. So you kind of have a lot of information before you even get in the room.
Right.
If that makes sense.
But that junior writer, you know, who's more of an unknown quantity, it seems like it's more likely that what's going to happen there is you're going to say,
Those are more likely to be a discussion. Right.
Yeah. So when you say, let us talk about it, that, you know, I think a lot of writers feel like, ugh, like
it's defeat.
It's defeat. But it's not always, obviously.
It's not always, and it's always, like when I said earlier that, again, every network has their own process. I know, again, for ours, we would usually talk about it as a team, and sort of pitch each other. But we definitely, even before I was a department head, had the ability to buy in the room when I worked for Sami. She's like, look, if you love it, buy it. You talk about it, you figure out how much you want to spend on it. So there's other ways to kind of, you know, hedge your risk, if that's one way to put it.
Right. If you're feeling some regret about that decision, you can always put in a very low ball offer.
I will not comment on that. I'm just saying if you're in the room and you really feel it, you buy it. And then later you go back and you're like, oh, you don't have to go in like
guns blazing.
Yes. Yeah. So, but I do think that there's always that pitch that comes in from a writer you didn't know that was a new play, and you're like, oh wow, that really pleasantly surprised me. Let me talk to the team and like make sure I look at their material again. And it's more you're doing your research, right, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Not doing your research. Hopefully you've read their material before they came in. But I do think there's usually some sort of a discussion process if it's someone you've never worked with before that's coming in totally clean. But definitely if there's you know, it's already sold a couple of places, you know, there are people at like a certain level, you know, that you're going to have to buy it in the room just to be in the game. And then you go decide what our appetite is.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So how about time of day? Did you notice a difference when you were hearing pitches in the afternoon? Were you more likely to buy stuff earlier in the day?
I would love to say to you, yes, that I'm sure there's some truth to that. Like that by the time it's 6 o'clock on a Friday of a week, you know, I'm sure I'm not as entertained as I was at 10:30 on Monday.
It'd be very human when it's the eighth one you're hearing that
right.
day.
I think there's just a human quality to that. But there's just the reality of there's only so many hours a day and you go in when you go in. So like I've literally had people like bring in ice cream or bring in coffee, or most executives, there's some part of the afternoon where you get your like coffee fix, whatever you need to do to kind of get you a little bit of an energy boost. So I'm not going to say that it doesn't matter, but I wouldn't like freak out if you have that time.
It's the kiss of death. 5 o'clock. I just know I just fight not to ever have those.
It's hard.
5 o'clock pitches.
It's hard. Seems like table reads too. Like if you get a late table read time, everyone's like, nobody wants to be there. It's not ideal, but it's not the kiss of death because we're there every day hearing pitches that whole time. And look, it sounds like so obvious, but I do feel like we're hoping we love your pitch. You know, I think the sense on the other side is like, oh, they just say no to everything. I want to hear pitches I want to buy. Like the best part of my job is getting excited about a pitch, going to advocate for it, and seeing that show go through and be successful. I don't want to pass. Like I don't want to have to call your agent and give bad news. Like that's not fun for anybody. So you're going in, I hope this is something I love because I want to be excited about my development this year. So that's the mindset. I think it's hard to think that, but that's generally what I can say when you go into pitch season. Like you're going in going, all right, here's what we're looking for. It's like a year of potential.
Yeah. It's what I always say to actors, you know, being on the other end of that, when I'm casting people, I'm just like, I want to like you.
Right.
I want people
to I'm not coming in wanting to hate you.
No, I'm wanting to like every actor that comes in genuinely because that makes my job easier. But as a writer, it's hard to translate that. Oh, they're the execs are, they are the same mindset.
Right.
They want to like this. How about, you know, where it is in terms of July versus, you know,
November, October.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you have a bigger budget at the beginning.
So yeah, that's just real. Like it's much easier to buy when your coffers are open, you're taking shots. This is a new writer. It's a little bit of a nutty idea. Let's take a flyer, especially as towards my last year. So at ABC, there were so like our budget every year, you know, got smaller and smaller and the number of scripts we could buy became less and less. So you had to be really rigorous in a way that towards the end of the year, there might've been a pitch or towards the end of the buying season that you would have probably bought in July as a flyer, but it didn't come in until October. And I only have X amount of slots left.
Right.
And again, I'm going to look at what else is still coming in. I'm going to be like, oh, and I still have these big players that are showrunners coming, like, so it matters. Like that is the time of day matters, but if it's good pitch, you'll be fine.
Time of year.
If you come in late in the season, everybody's down on their budget. It just is much harder.
Okay. So are there,
so get in early.
Yeah. Are there other, I mean, you talked about the happy endings, which Sami talks about, but are there memorable pitches that you remember was just like, wow, that was just like an amazing pitch.
Oh, for sure. There's tons of them. What should I start with? It feels very weird. Like I'm like calling people out for being A+. I'm just kidding. And then other people are like, what about my pitch?
I don't think anyone's going to, you know.
They're like, nobody's
be
listening.
Mad. They're like, oh, she said it was so good.
Ninotchka Khan's like Greatest American Hero pitch was super funny. She and Rachna Frockbaum. And it was just like a really smart, interesting take on doing Greatest American Hero as like a woman of color, but with a really fun like comedic point of view. And like I genuinely remember Channing Dungey laughing so hard like her stomach hurt.
I loved the pilot too. I thought the pilot turned out
was
great.
But it just was like one of those pitches where the two of them are just fun, and it was all of us going like, wouldn't it be great to have like a badass diverse superhero woman? And it was just flat out funny. So again, like smart and had something to say, but also like really, really made us laugh. Like that definitely stands out. Absolutely the Fresh Off the Boat. I keep meaning Notch. Fresh Off the Boat was a really good pitch. I remember them having video of Eddie Huang because he wasn't there. And I was just like, oh, he's like blacker than I am. Because he's super like right. hip hop. Yeah. And it was just, again, like really clear characters. She had a personal connection to that sort of a story. Definitely Kenya with Black-ish, with Lawrence Fishburne and Anthony Anderson and Kenya telling their stories about. And that's a classic example of one that I recently was like looking back on my notes from that pitch. My notes are all over. Like, I don't know that they pitched a pilot story. Like, I don't, but they had really specific stories about raising their kids and having done better than their parents and looking at the values they were passing on to their kids and going like, how do we don't see a show that's dealing with this yet from each of their perspectives that were very memorable and that I could then, that was one that neither, like Sami was not in it. I don't think Paul was, but it was competitive. And so we knew we were probably gonna have to buy it in the room and deal with, not deal with, but figure out how high to go. But our ability to go, no, they have a unique take on family was everything. So definitely in my, there's still stories I remember them telling that they haven't done episodes on yet. Yeah. Not in a good way, but that yeah. just stood out to me as like, oh, right, you've never heard somebody say that yet. And yet it resonated as true. So those are some of the ones that I remember.
And now you don't have to name names about this, but are there mistakes? You know, we talked about reading right off the page. Are there other things that you saw a lot that writers do where you're just like, dudes, you should not be doing that in a pitch? Like,
I would say making assumptions, like assuming that people know. If you're doing a format and you're adapting the format, yes, that executive should have watched the format and should know every character you're talking about, but assuming they do and having such a shorthand that it doesn't track without having seen it
right.
is something that I would have seen people do quite a bit. I gotta think about that. I'm sure there are others, but that's the first one that comes to mind.
You can't, but you remember just
some I mean, of the pitches that like were just corny. Oh, for through. Sure. Corny gags, like as much as the idea of like dressing up like a leprechaun or I like that sort of stuff is just awkward.
Visual aids in general. I mean, are there any, because I've done pitches where I had a big cast of characters and I brought in headshots.
That I think is helpful.
Okay.
But that's different from like literally somebody
becoming
coming
in
like
costume.
Yeah. I'm just saying for me, somebody else might enjoy that. So,
sorry,
I don't want to ruin it.
That...
You see enough of it that really? You're, and then it's just like awkward. And I'm not going to call any of them out, but there's definitely been some where you just are like, one of our junior executives at ABC had an experience with one of those. And like afterwards, he just laid on the floor. He was like, that was so awkward. So, yeah, I think like dress up or like, magic tricks, or I don't know, anything that seems gimmicky. I know, again, the notion of it being entertaining, you sometimes want to then like gimmick it up. And I think that is really tends to fall flat,
yeah.
unfortunately.
How long do you think a comedy pitch should be?
I would say somewhere between half an hour, 45 minutes.
Okay.
Question, you know, obviously you leave some time for questions. I think if it's a full hour, that's probably too long. I think if it's 30 to 45 and you're like most places, at least I know when I was at ABC, we set aside like an hour. So maybe it's less than that. But if you're assuming you'll have that much time for like small talk, 35, 45 minutes of your actual pitch and then questions, you know, I think it's probably around there.
Okay. So now someone sold a pitch and getting into story documents and outlines. Those, and for those listeners who might not know, a story document is just sort of a shorter outline, like a 2 or 3 page. People always call
it's the worst step.
It's the worst step.
It's the worst.
It's my most
it's
hated.
For sure.
Step.
It's horrible.
It didn't used to exist. I've been doing this long enough where
you
I went
knew
through
when
a
it
time
didn't.
Where there wasn't this step. And
when
it was
did it
better.
Come in, Andrew?
I can't remember what year it was, but it was suddenly
like who
wait,
did
you
it?
Want to do what? And it was so I was called like a one pager, and I was just like. A one page. You know how hard it is to write a one page.
We need to find out who started it.
Yeah, I feel like it was CBS, but I'm not. But I'm not certain. But yes, so it's this weird, almost an outline, but not an
right.
outline kind of thing. So what? I was glad to hear that you don't even
They're
like
horrible.
That step. It's horrible, right?
It's horrible. No one does them well. Like no one quite knows what a good version is. It's probably this stage people get the most tortured over.
Yeah. So why?
Like why? I asked you. I was like, who started this?
I know, but why,
they were doing it when I
started
it.
Other people have continued it. Yeah. Why do these things exist? Like, did you ever find it helpful? Did it, you know, I assume it was just trying to avoid problems at the outline stage, but I don't know that it ever really does.
Does. Here would be my best guess at it. And I do think, to your point, it can be very hard to figure out how to be concise and hit the points because everybody kind of wants different points, right? Like, again, at ABC, we really want to know, like, what's your theme? What do you want to say? I don't get the sense CBS cares about that at all. I don't think Fox cares about that either. So, you know, kind of figuring out what each person wants to be emphasized in their story document is probably why that's such a pain in the neck for everybody. What I do think is helpful is that if it's kind of like an elevator pitch, like if you can't articulate in some concise way what your episode's about, then there's a problem. Like if it's so much about the twists and turns of the plot, you know, then you're sort of like, what do you, like, what are we actually doing?
Right.
So the notion of, as you said, I think avoiding getting all the way to outline with something that you had a very like fundamental issue with, I think the spirit of it was to not have people spend so much time detailing things out if at the end of the day, you don't want a story about women's lib. I don't know. I just made that up.
Right. So it seems like what it should be,
because they do it for series too, and it's the same struggle with series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the description. I'm going to date myself by saying like the TV guide description, but the description
right.
that's on your guide on, you know, your DVR, that's a few sentences.
Right.
That seems like, okay, that's a step I understand.
Because
right. that really is, here's just the gist of what this episode is about.
Right.
Like they realize they don't have any couple friends and they want to make some couple friends or whatever. You know, it's just like, okay, I get that it's going to be this search for, you know, we need to make a new couple friend.
Right.
But when you're in this like one page to three page to four, like where you're trying to explain each step
right.
of the story,
right.
but not with enough space that you can really flesh it out, that's where it gets tricky.
It is a flawed system, Andrew. I cannot lie about that.
Yeah.
I cannot look you in the face and say that it is perfect.
It functions perfectly.
It is not at all.
Yeah.
But again, I think the spirit of it is in going, if there's like fundamental issues with the story, to not have the writers spend so much time going down the road that you can't catch it.
Right.
But I do think that story document winds up tripping people up more often. So yeah.
Yeah, what I find as a writer is it's an enthusiasm killer.
Yeah.
And that's the worst thing.
You just get worn down.
You get worn down before you've actually done any of the things
right,
that matter.
That matter.
You know, you're not getting to the fun parts of writing, and you're not getting to hear how your characters talk
right.
and do any of that, and you're just stuck in this place, and you end up spending a lot of time between the studio and the network on this back
trying
and forth.
The story
thing, and all it's
right.
doing is like making you doubt yourself and question yourself and taking away your enthusiasm.
Well, Jesus,
like,
Andrew. No, I'm just kidding. No. I get it, because I'm like, the amount of times that
yeah.
we would be going, oh, but, and I can't say to you that I'm like, oh, there's anyone that like was the prototype of
yeah.
it.
I
think every show.
Send me examples of great ones, and I read them. Like this is just not
right.
a literary form that is
yeah.
good.
Every show kind of finds their own way with once they get into series. You know,
yeah.
God willing, you get there with their current execs of like how to so kind of cut
that point,
through
you can
it.
Sometimes get on the phone and say, "Hey, we're
and
gonna
just
do
pitch
show
it
about
through."
This.
Right, but it is it's an imperfect.
So
yeah,
the
for sure.
so the and then the outline. I mean, I know ABC. You're probably, you know, like you said, you're looking for what is the show about. And you're probably also looking for the heart,
yes.
right? Those making sure.
Right.
So how important is it in that outline that outline be really funny?
I think for the outline, it's more important that the story tracks than it is that, again, obviously you want there to be some humor to the writing, but I wasn't as much reading the outline going, they didn't make me laugh here, as much as I was going like, does the character track? Did the character arcs make sense? The act breaks work? You know, kind of the logistics of the story more than I was looking for specific dialogue. Or, you know what I mean? Because a lot of times that stuff, to your point about character and voice, is going to come out in that.
Right.
So look, I always think it's important to make sure that your writing is entertaining, but I don't think it needs to be like belabored with like jokes for every, you know, like I think everybody has a lot to read. And again, obviously I can only speak for myself.
Right.
I think I was literally more looking at, does the story track? Does character arc track? Are we hitting our act breaks?
So if it had all that, you're not going to get an outline and be like, and start to panic, like, oh, this script isn't going to be funny because the
if it feels super emotional, because again, yes, you want moments of emotion, but there have definitely been some I've read that feel just heavy,
right?
You know, where you're going like, okay, maybe we're taking on a subject and we're not making choices with that subject that feel like they're going to lead to comedy. It just felt like a downer. So I'm not saying you don't have to be cognizant of it, but if it reads to, if it, it's finding the right balance with it, I would say.
As a writer, I'm always conscious of people get, you know, people are, you know, executives are humans, and they, a joke the third time you've read it is not as funny as the first time you read it. So it's like, oh, if I put my good joke in the outline, then they're already, let alone even, sometimes it's like the first draft, you just want to be able to
just hold it. Oh, you guys think about it that way?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. If you wanted to, like, go the distance. But then again, it's always tricky because you're like, well, you want them to, at every stage.
Right.
I mean, you guys need, you're enthusiastic, you hear a pitch and you're enthusiastic, right? And that has to continue at the outline stage, at the first draft stage. Are there times when you have to keep giving notes on something where you kind of feel like, I know this is just not headed towards...
Of course not, Nan. Yes. And all the time, unfortunately. It's a lot of... It's a business of... I mean, on the network side, especially when you're developing that many scripts, not everything does go the distance. And not every... Like, some of them are great pilots. And through the pilot process, you're like, oh, this isn't a series. And that was hard because you'd get into like screenings and the rest of the company's like, this is amazing. And you're like, ooh, we blew our wad. Yeah. Like, we don't have anymore.
We don't have episode two.
So yeah, again, I think there are various stages of, I've definitely worked with people who had theories about, you know, don't peak too soon. Or, I mean, every show has its own, you know, chemistry and timeline, but it is, sometimes you're working on something and you're just going, oh, or it's clear that the show that writer really wants to make is not the show that's going to fly at the network you're working at.
Right.
Not that it's bad, but just that it's taking a certain direction that you're like, oh, that's going to be tough. And then you have the choice of, are you going to like try to wrestle them to the ground to write a show that actually they're not going to want to make if it gets picked up? Or do you let them write the thing that they really want to say and then just see how it goes? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Does... In those times when writers push back on notes,
right?
You just talk about how that is from your side of things.
The other side of the phone call.
Yeah.
I think it is the hardest thing for you guys as writers to figure out what to fight for, because it's a collaborative process. There's a bunch of people that come into it, but at the end of the day, it's your vision and it's your show. And if you take every note, you'll be left with nothing. And you're going to hate it. And when it fails, the network's not going to go, well, they took every note. No, they're just going to, your show failed. So I don't ever see pushback as a, like, how dare you? I have an edict. As much as I see it as my job to listen and try to understand where the writer's coming from and what their intention is. And if that intention wasn't clear, then how do we get that across? More than it is. I'm not personally a fan of like pitching a fix, like giving a very specific, why don't they write an elephant at Akbar? You know, like, is that, I'm like, no, what's the note? Like, what's not working for you or what's not clear? And then the writer hopefully should figure out their way to address it. But I think it's a hard area for writers to navigate, because it literally, if there's a writer that takes every note, I'm nervous. That's what I would say.
Because
actually then
nervous.
I'm going, what are you actually going to stand for?
Right.
Because if you're going to take everybody's note on everything, you do not have a clear vision for your show, which again may or may not be surprising to people. But I'm like, the shows that we have that are the most successful are people that had very strong, clear opinions. It didn't mean they took every one of our notes, very far from that. But we had a discussion about it and came out on the other side with an understanding of, okay, here's their intention. Okay, and those are some of the best episodes. So I think it's about how you push back, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Not being confrontational, not being a jerk, not being disrespectful, not being short. You know, I think just tone of voice and how you articulate it
go a long way.
Right. I think people that come into the dynamic seeing it as us versus them, it'll be a long, hard ride. And in addition to that, our jobs are to be your biggest advocate. Like, right. Literally, the network executive's job, I know everyone sees it as like torturer of writer. my best day isn't that. Like, my best day is if I'm talking to marketing and I'm talking to ad sales, I'm talking to press, I'm articulating your vision to all of the other people in the company that need to mobilize to get an audience to it. And I can only do that if you articulate it clearly.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So again, the pushback thing to me is more about getting on the same page, which means, okay, if I had a certain note that you're like, that is not my intention at all, then I need to understand better what you're trying to do.
So on one end of the spectrum is the writer who takes every note.
Right.
And then...
the one who fights just to fight.
The one who fights every... The one who doesn't
Yeah, that's exhausting too.
Note,
yeah, nobody wants to deal with that either.
So, yeah. So for all of us, it's finding our place in
finding
the middle
Finding the middle ground in my first Boston comedy. Do you know Quan Fung?
Yeah.
Do you ever work with Quan?
Mm-hmm.
I remember Quan, when I worked at 20th, would say to some of the writers we work with, like, to put on like a post-it note, like, what is essential? Like, what are those things that you are not willing to compromise? And know that for yourself, so that as you're going into the process with your studio, with your producer, with your network, you know, like, because there's, it's like an obstacle course for you guys with your ideas, and there's going to be some collaboration that's going to ameliorate it, you know, that you're going to be like, oh wow, that really elevated what I was trying to do. And then there's going to be something that you're like, that is a show, but it's not my show, and only you know that. And if you don't have that foundation for yourself, then it's very easy to get tossed about.
Right.
Does it, by people who have 60 projects on their list, right? So they're coming in going, maybe this, and then they're going on to another notes call.
Yeah.
You're the only one who knows your show that intrinsically. And this is, I keep telling other people stories, but it's such, for me, a good example of My Name is Earl was a show we did at 20th with Greg Garcia. And I remember they wanted him to cut Earl's mustache. Something that seems like really mundane. Not mundane, but like, okay, don't have him have a mustache. And Greg really dug his heels in, because the whole point was the character was not clean cut. Like, he was supposed to be, like, didn't have a shit together.
Yeah.
Can I cuss? Is that bad?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And as much as that may have seemed like just cut the mustache, let it go, it was like that slippery slope of if an NBC at the time was just sort of coming off of all their like Pretty People, Friends and Will and Grace shows. And I think they bought it and then, I'm just speculating, got a little nervous of like, is this too lowbrow?
Right.
And like, this mustache was probably the first of many cleanups to come.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember kind of thinking, oh, why is he finding this mustache so hard? Just cut it. And then later I'm like, no, that was the right one.
Yeah,
because if they were going to cave,
the mustache is also
right,
just like,
it's just like another guy.
Yeah.
And that was actually the right thing to dig your heels in on, because it was an indicator of the whole ride. So that's what I meant of like those essential elements of like, no, it was a lowbrow show. Like, they were white trash. Like,
yeah,
that was the point. And if you weren't comfortable with that, you shouldn't make that show.
Yeah.
So I think there's a little bit of that take it or leave it attitude that's not bad to have. And again, I mean that not in a disrespectful or mean way, but the best scenarios are if your vision lines up with the person who buys it. If it doesn't, there's so many outlets now. Like, find the buyer that wants to do that show. Otherwise, you're going to be tortured while they try to, like, you think it's great to just sell your show. It's worse. I mean, you've developed. Like, it's worse to be somewhere where you're like, they're trying to turn me into a Volvo and I really want to make a Corvette. You'd rather go someplace that wants a Corvette.
Right, because you don't know how to be the Volvo.
You're not a Volvo, and you're never going to make that series. You're going to be tortured the whole time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you talk about the writers take every note, sometimes it's like the commerce kind of pitches you were talking about before. You know, it's sort of, well, I'm just pitching this because I think I can sell it, and you're already in the mindset of, I just want to please.
Right.
So it could be whatever. If you guys want it to be this, I'll make it this. And then those just never end up working out.
No, and again, I'm not saying you won't sell it.
Right.
I'm not even saying it may not get shot. I call them Franken shows. Like, there would be these Franken shows, and we'd always have a couple on our list because, you know, we'd had our talking points and we said we wanted X and it came in. But again, the ones that usually go the distance were really distinctive and had some sort of personal connection to them and had something to say more than it was like an assignment for.
Are you thinking about testing, you know, along these lines? Is that in your mind, or are you... You know, you do this for a number of years and you learn all these lessons each season.
Right.
How hard is it to just maintain a gut instinct and not be thinking like, oh, well, we had something like that and that tested poorly, so I want to try and avoid making that mistake again? Are these thoughts that are going through your head?
I'm not saying they don't come in. If you like the pitch, you buy it. I mean, you're going to have those thoughts about how you get it through the rest of the system. The obstacle course that you as an executive have to make of getting through screenings and, you know, that stuff. But if it's a pitch that you believe in from a writer that you believe in, you've heard a pitch on everything. Like, there's very few things that you haven't heard some version of. I was trying to think for a minute of something that came in where I'm like, I've literally never heard that. So again, it's usually about execution. So that even if you've done a similar type of show, it wouldn't stop you from buying it. Might it play a factor in terms of the way you develop? It should. Meaning if there's certain things you learn and you're like, there was one year, I don't know if it was my first year running the department. For some reason, we had a lot of pilots that had people die in them. I don't know why. It just happened that year. And it's just one of those things, if it's a 21-minute episode, like, it's really hard to come back from death in any third act, first act, wherever it is. It's just hard. And we all were like, so we're just not going to kill people in our pilots. Maybe it's not a hard and fast rule forever.
Right.
But
it's just going to get harder to get that death through.
It's harder. It was going to be harder the next year if somebody was coming in with the cancer pitch.
Right.
When we'd had like four shows that had
Pearl and you.
Right. No, no, Andrew, no.
No, it's okay.
I think it plays a factor, but literally the research is a tool for what the president of the network wants to do.
Right.
If they want it and it's good research, then they'll emphasize it. If they want it and it's bad research, then they're going to not emphasize it. Like, nothing. I have seen shows that maybe wouldn't have gone forward jump up because there was great testing. But I feel like that was more like in the 80s. Like, I don't know that that happens anymore. Maybe. Again, I can't speak for everyone because we definitely have had things that tested. But if no one believed in it, we didn't do it just because of testing.
Okay. Final draft has been delivered. This is the most mysterious part for writers, is what happens after...
When the silence descends?
Yes. What's going on there? What are you doing? You've gotten all your, you know, you've gotten your drafts in.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to decide which ones are going to get shot. What does that look like?
I don't know what I can say without killing you, Andrew. I'm totally kidding. I'm totally kidding. There's a lot of meetings with the team and with the president, who is reading material for both comedy and drama, and deciding what the slate's going to be. There's a lot of debate. We at least sort of had, I don't know if I can say, I guess I can say, what are they going to do?
You're not there anymore.
I know, I'm like, I don't work there. What are they going to do? We had like a board, and you have magnets that like have the different shows on them, and you have how many slots you have, and you have how many scripts you have, and you do a lot of talking and voting and sleeping on it and coming back the next day when a different, the presidents typically are reading certain things on certain days, so they haven't obviously read everything we've read. So you're doing a lot of meetings with them, and even as a team. Honestly, of like, what are we going to advocate for? You're not all on the same page.
Are there scripts that don't even get passed along to the president?
Not necessarily.
They're reading even the ones where the team is kind of like, this is going nowhere.
They read most stuff, yeah, because you just don't know.
You don't know. Okay.
I mean, I think especially they read a lot. Like, they have tough jobs.
And then you're having these sort of secret.
I'm not going to say they read them all the way through. You know, right. I'm not going to say that every, if something doesn't strike for them, that they finish it. I don't know. I can't speak to their process of every president, but most stuff gets to them.
And then you guys are taking secret votes, kind of. What do those votes look like when you have the whole
They're
team?
Very low tech, actually. Sorry.
Like, I remember thinking hands.
That. I remember thinking that. I was like, if people saw like what actually goes on, that it's super duper low tech. I mean, our department at the time, we literally had like a whiteboard, and like we would put hash marks like next to shows. Like, we'd go through and go, okay, we have three slots left. What are your three? And then the shows would get a, you know, maybe a vote, or usually there was some version of that. And then you would have some version of that in the president's office. They would have read something. They would give their opinions. We talk about it. usually, I feel like they get off on it a little bit. And I mean, I've worked for a couple of them, not good, but I think because the team, and we don't always agree.
Right.
So you'll have certain people that are going to advocate very hard for certain projects and others don't. And then you're looking at what the needs are for, if you have a certain amount of single camera family shows and you really need multicams, do you want to do young ensembles? If you do, again, when I was at ABC, I was like, look, if we ever want to do something that's not family, we have to put something on the air that's not family or people are never going to sell it to us. And how do we do that if we do one pilot a year and then don't pick it up? So we'd have a lot of those conversations of like, how many slots do we want to do for like ensembles or multicams and how many for single, for family? So it's not just... It definitely is the things that you love, but then it becomes a bit of the alchemy of like, what do you need? So if you know that you're going to have a hole on Tuesday at 8:30 or Tuesday at 8, or what, if you know the middle is going away and you need a companion for X, how many things are you developing to fill that slot? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's not just there's the like, do I love it? And then there's like, what are the needs? Do we know we need a certain amount of things to fill this slot because this, we know this, it's the last year of Modern Family is coming up, so we have to figure out what Wednesday night's going to look like without Modern Family for the first time. So those sorts of questions, like we literally had boxes in our development report that were genres, so that as you're buying, again, you're not just sort of buying like a candy store of like, let's get one of everything. Throughout the season, you're looking going, okay, we have a lot of couples without kids, but we don't have any rom-coms. I'm making this up. Like, yeah, whatever the specific genres are. So again, throughout the season, you're trying to make sure you have options throughout your development so that when the president's looking, if they look up and go, I feel like my first year with Paul, maybe we did Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23. And that was the year that Two Broke Girls came out as a spec. And we tried to get it. We didn't get it. And Paul was like, I want something young and edgy. And we just didn't have it.
Hmm.
And Apartment 23 had been developed at 20th for Fox. But a couple of our execs used to work at, you know, like they remembered it as a spec and dug it up. And so we did a sort of like, oh, Sam used to call them fire drills. Fire drill, because all of a sudden he was like, I want something young and female and edgy. And like we hadn't been developing for that. So we shot that as a spec script that turned, that went on to become a series.
So it had been bought. Was it written on spec, or was that had been bought and passed on the year before it was developed? So it was actually,
I'm not sure when it was actually. It was developed at 20th for Fox at some point. I don't know if it was 1 year, 2 year. I'm not sure exactly when.
So that's just one of those things that, yeah, as a writer, it's just like we're imagining these kinds of things are happening. But suddenly, it's
there's a whole
female, you know, young female ensemble,
right,
kind of raunchy, you know, and it's just like you just luck out that at that moment.
Yeah, I think 20th got a call going, hey, we want that script Ninotchka wrote. Can you get that out of Fox for us? There was a couple years that happened. I think we did one thing called Lost and Found. That was a Warner Brothers spec. So there definitely would be, again, once your scripts have come in, if you're seeing you're missing things,
right?
Maybe you bought certain things that didn't pan out. So, and there's always that question of like, when do you send a spec script out?
Yeah.
There's that window where you're kind of going, oh, we thought these were going to be great. Doesn't look like they're going to go the distance, but we really need it X slot. And, you know, there's definitely windows for that.
So the, because I was going to ask about specs, but it seems like that the timing of when all the scripts that have been developed are coming in is a good time to drop a spec.
It is in terms of that's when the opening is. It's hard because the execs are reading so much.
Right.
And then they're getting so many specs. But that's the time when you know. Like when you've at least seen a draft of almost everything. It's like after Christmas. And you have some sense of, you know, what's coming in looking good or not. You'll have a sense of like, oh, I'm going to have major needs. Or I'm really covered. You always have some needs. We definitely, almost most years, maybe not the years I ran the department, but I remember we shot a pilot that was a pitch we had tried to buy and didn't get. And then when it came to pickup time, Warner Brothers came to us because it didn't go forward where they sold it. and we still wanted it. It still fit our needs, and we wound up shooting. It was called The Smart One with, like, Malin Ackerman and Portia de Rossi. But and that was one that was something we tried to buy, didn't get, got developed, I think, at NBC. And they brought it back to us when NBC didn't shoot it, and we shot it.
And so they had made the deal where it was possible for that to happen.
Right.
Like, it could be extracted from the place.
Right. I feel like most places now try to build in some sort of, especially for very competitive pitches, some sort of an early out.
You get those.
Right. It's harder to get it if you're not competitive. Yeah.
Which brings me to the question I get asked all the time about Dead Pilot Society is, hey, have any of these scripts that you've done been resurrected? Not happened
yet.
And I always think, because, you know, in the 40 or so pilots we've done from all these great writers, there's a lot of good material.
Right.
I always think there's a taint on things when they've been passed on and they haven't, that they haven't gone, that it's hard to overcome that thinking, oh, well, wasn't, you know, that network passed, so there must be a problem with that show. I mean, do you think that's not true?
I just cited like two things that were passed on that we actually, I mean, honestly, I joke a little bit with Melvin Marr, another great producer. I feel like I'm getting shout outs, but because there's several things that he developed for Fox the Goldbergs originally was developed at Fox, and then ABC developed it and it did really well for us. Speechless was originally developed for Fox, and then I don't personally feel that way.
So
I'm not saying other people don't. I think it's more about the specifics. I mean, by the way, Bless This Mess is another example. Melvin Marr, but, you know, who was initially developed and shot for Fox and is on ABC and is having a second season.
Yeah.
So, again, I can't speak for everyone, obviously, but I think it really for us was much more about, is it on brand? And again, something like, I can say Bless This Mess, which even though they bought it after I left, we had wanted to work with Lake Bell. She chose to go work with Liz Merriweather at 20th, which we get, but just to what I was saying earlier about how you're tracking and looking for people you want to work with,
right.
It was somebody that we had just called and done general, like said, will she do a general? And we feel like she feels right for our brand. And when she's ready, let us know. And then she went to 20th, which of course was going to land at Fox. That idea was always probably a better ABC show than it was like a Fox Sunday night show.
Yeah.
But that being said, so there was always a part of me, and Melvin would always joke and say like, hey, when Fox doesn't pick it up, we're bringing it over. And they did. And it got on the air. So I don't think it's that. I think it's more about, is it on brand for you? And I think especially for the networks, our comedy brands are pretty distinctive. You know what I mean? Like, there's not, like, I wouldn't look at something like, oh, it wasn't right for CBS, it wouldn't be right for us. I'm like, no, our stuff is, we probably have more heart than Fox and CBS. That's not really their thing. You know, so just because it didn't work for them doesn't mean it doesn't hit what the targets are for that particular network.
Yeah. So it just means that all the pilots we've done here at Dead Pilot Society must just
suck. No, it doesn't mean that. I don't know who's listening. Are the buyers listening to know that they should do it?
I don't know. They should be.
That's what you should do. You need to do, like, a buyer's roundtable to listen to them.
They're all out there. So we talk a lot when we interview the writers about the phone call, you know, the bad, how are, and we'll wrap up
with a downer?
No,
come on, Andrew.
Those must be tough, right? You must, you know, making
it's
those
horrible.
Calls. It's horrible, right?
It's horrible.
What are you trying to kind of like get off the phone as quickly as possible?
I block it out. No, it's really, you definitely try to enjoy the good calls because there's less of those than the bad ones, right?
Yeah.
So like when you get to make the good calls, it's why you get that call and there's like 50 people on the phone. You're like,
why is
everybody here? And like, because everybody wants, there's like,
right.
It's such a small percentage
of
the
calls
other calls.
It's the bad call. Yeah.
Right. So that is a reason those are such, like, you're like, why did everyone have to do that? Because everyone's like, I want to be a part of good news. We as executives, you buy the projects with all potential. Like, you don't buy projects going, oh, this isn't going to go the distance. to waste anyone's time. So the intention is to go, this could be one that becomes the next Friends or Seinfeld or, you know, timeless hit. And for that individual writer, you know, this has been the last, you know, 8 or so months of their life. And that even though we're going to go make some pilots, they're not. Yeah. And that's hard. Like, there's no easy way around that. There's no way that's not tough or this. I can't think of a single person that's flippant about that. When you are getting on the phone with somebody that you know has put their, like, blood, sweat, and tears into this story and, like, bent over backwards trying to do that story document or do those last-minute rewrites that come in at the last minute before you're getting it to the president. So I don't know that I have – I don't even want to say an answer. It's just hard, and you just kind of go in that day, and you, to your point, the studio usually makes the first call, which – I don't know how they do. I usually talk to a studio person. I'm like, I haven't had to do it on that side. So by the time we call, like, they already know. And it's just hard. I for sure have cried. I'm sure there's a couple of people I cried on their call. Like, it was maybe not that the most, not maybe. Sure, it was not the most professional thing. But
I'm sure there are ones that you loved that
didn't, yeah, there's, you know, ones you loved and writers that you know, like, did their best and it wasn't about them. It just was not the thing we needed that year. Or, like I said, when it got down to those last two slots, we didn't even get into stuff about ownership or how many from what agents, you know, like, there's so many factors that come into play. And, like, the ownership thing is real.
Yeah.
There's a real... Every year gets incredibly more and more complicated in terms of how many things you can actually pick up from outside studios versus things that you own. So there's all sorts of politics that come into play. It's my friends that are actors, I say the same thing to them. I'm like, it is crazy. I've been in sessions where people were hands down the best, and that person might just go, I don't like blondes. Like, what do you do with that? So it's, again, especially with comedy, which is so subjective. If my boss just didn't get it, I can't argue with that. You know, like, yeah. I can't really defend it. I feel like with dramas, you can kind of go, I'm going to make this storyline more sticky, or I'm going to... If they're just like, it didn't make me laugh...
That's kind of a conversation ender.
It's kind of ends it. That's what I meant about, you know, if they didn't even finish it because they just didn't...
Yeah.
They're like, I got 50 other scripts to read and I couldn't even... You're like, I can't convince them to make it. So it's hard. And I, you know...
Is the worst part of the job?
It's close to the worst part.
What's the worst part?
The budget. Ugh. I'm not a numbers person. So, all right, I don't want to deal with that stuff.
I want to end on a downer. What's your favorite part of doing this? You've done it, you know, different sides, studio, network. Now you're, you know, you've been Netflix.
Right.
That side, you're, what do you continue to love about doing this?
Easily working with, I mean, the best part of it is when a writer or talent comes in and has an idea that you think is amazing and that you get to work on. And, like, one of the most fun things is, like, going to set and being like, oh my God, remember when this was just, like, that little idea that you had? Then we were just, like, sitting in the office and, like, look at all the people that now have jobs and are getting paid to make that story come to life is the best part of our job. I mean, that is... I don't use the word, like, being an advocate. Not, like, being advocating for, you know, human rights. Like, there's much... There, our world is messy and there's a lot of stuff going on, but I do think when people come in with a very specific vision and being able to be a part of marshaling a whole system to get behind that vision, and then when you're like, oh right, the world is responding to that, that's the best part of your job. Like, giving notes, nobody likes doing that. Like, I will highly doubt that you're gonna talk to any executive, well, maybe somebody does, who wants to, like, get on the phone and, like, torture a writer. The best part is when you get to be like, this was amazing. When you can go to your boss's office and say, we heard the best pitch today, or the cut came in and your boss is like, this is great. Obviously we have to make this, and gets it. Those are the best parts of your job. Or, and I say that, freaking, we're in comedy. So whether that's talent too, or, you know, like, I was in Montreal recently and I just remember years ago seeing people like Jermaine Fowler and Little Rel, like, seeing them there and being like, oh, there's something there. And then seeing where their careers have gone, and you're like, right, like, that's that's the best part of your job, is being able to go, even if the show they developed for me wasn't the one that got them there, we were a step in their journey of finding their voice, finding their next opportunity. And I think that for me is why we do the jobs. It's to help you. Like, believe it or not. No, I'm serious, because I know it's not. I'm like, no, seriously, that's the part that everybody looks for and enjoys. I thank people like Kenya and Nanachka, Melvin all the time, because I'm like, if I didn't have those projects to champion, I don't know, like, what I would, you know, like, what are you going to, just sitting there giving notes all day? No, you do it because it makes you laugh. Like, when you're sitting there, and I'm like, there's certain episodes that I can watch over and over again, and yes, I read the outline, and yes, I read the script, but it doesn't matter because it still makes me laugh. That's the best part of the job.
Yeah, that's a good note to end on.
Better than the past better calls. Than the, we won't go back to that.
Tragic past calls. Jamila, this was so great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For doing this. It was a pleasure.
Bye.
Listen, I'm a hotshot Hollywood movie producer. You have until I finish my glass of kombucha to pitch me your idea. Go.
All right, it's called Who Shot Ya? A movie podcast that isn't just a bunch of straight white dudes. I'm Iffy Whiteyway, the new host of the show and a certified BBN.
BBN?
Buff black nerd.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi, an elderly gay and legit film critic who wrote a book on Christmas movies.
I'm Drea Clark, a loud white lady from Minnesota.
Each week, we talk about a new movie in theaters and all the important issues going on in the film industry.
It's like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner meets Cruising.
And if it helps seal the deal, I can flex my muscles while we record each episode.
I'm sorry, this is a podcast? I'm a movie producer. How did you get in here?
Iffy, quick, start flexing.
Bicep, lats, chest. Who Shot Ya? Dropping every Friday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And that is it for our very special episode. This show is produced by myself and Ben Blacker and our associate producer, Noah Findling. I want to really thank Jamila Hunter for making the time to talk to me. The best ways to support this podcast are to subscribe, to leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts, and to tell a friend. Come on, you probably have at least one friend who would like this podcast, right? So tell them. Also, you should really follow us on all those evil social media outlets, Twitter at Dead Pilots Pod and Instagram and Facebook at Dead Pilot Society. That way you'll find out about all of our live shows. We've got one coming up September 14th, but it is sold out. We will have another one in December. Until next time, I am your host, Andrew Reich. Thank you for listening.